you're welcome.
Good morning, everyone. I really want to... Can you hear me? Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I really want to thank Nina for opening her home. So wonderful to meet all of you. A special thank you to Linda for inviting me to share some words of Torah, specifically focused on Israel and what Israel means to us. Although I don't think that this is a crowd that needs to be sold on the importance of Israel, the centrality of Israel. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir already, but the truth is actually makes it a little bit easier. But before I begin my remarks, I want to pick up on something that Linda said. You know, a lot of times in the rabbinate, especially in the age in which we live, the Jewish community as a whole has become so fragmented. And the Jewish community as a whole has sometimes become so polarized. And the truth is, and we'll discuss this a little bit later, a lot of it plays out in the current state of Israel. And how beautiful it is, even if you didn't ask me to come and to speak this morning, I feel so privileged that I was able just to sit in this room with all of you. As Linda mentioned, so many different parts of the community, so many different spectrums of Judaism, so many different flavors, so many different personalities, so many different kinds of people coming together. There are very few causes in today's day and age which are able to bring our greater community together. And I would give you all a charge, and maybe this is something Linda could work on in her free time. You have to figure out a way to build on this. And building on this, you'll excuse me, doesn't mean selling more bonds. And building on this does not mean raising more money. Building on this means taking the achdus, taking the unity that is palpable in this room, and figuring out how to replicate it in other arenas, and figuring out how to go ahead and bring our greater people together. Because, my friends, we spend so much time drawing our lines in the sand. We spend so much time sometimes identifying how I'm not like you and you're not like me, that we forget to go ahead and try to focus on the things that really bring us together, the things that really unify us. And I have to thank you, because as Linda mentioned, we're in the middle of the 3 weeks. And specifically now, we're in the middle of the 9 days. The 9 days that begin from the beginning of the Jewish month of Av and culminate on Sunday with Tisha B'Av. And it's a days of incredibly intense mourning. So I apologize for my lack of personal grooming. Some of us have the custom not to shave during these days as a sign of mourning over that which has been lost. 2,000 years of mourning are compacted into 9 days. Mourning over temples, mourning over pogroms, crusades, the Holocaust, victims of terror. The truth is, the Jew could mourn 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and we still would not be able to mourn for the enormity of our collective and individual losses. And it's not just our collective losses. It's during these days that we mourn everything that is in a state of disrepair in this world. People who struggle with illness, people who struggle with all different types of challenges. We mourn that, because it's during this time of year that we recognize that the world is not as it should be, that there's a certain spiritual equilibrium that is missing from our universe, because we don't yet have a rebuilt Jerusalem, we don't yet have our temple, and the truth is, it's wonderful to be in your home, but this is not where we belong. This is not our, I mean, I don't mean in your home. I'm happy, I'm very happy. Home is great, it's beautiful, I feel like I'm on vacation. You might see me in your backyard occasionally.
Just give me a warning.
But we know that this is not our home. Our ancestral home is the land of Israel. And whether or not we have plans to get there, plans to live there, plans to visit there, and you look deep inside yourself, we feel that something is not right. And all of that, all of this disconnect traces itself back, not to what other nations did to us, but my dear friends, unfortunately, because of what we did to each other and what we often do to ourselves. You see, when there is shalom, when there is peace, when there is unity, we could accomplish great things. When there is discord, when there is strife, when there is infighting, everything begins to fall apart. One of my teachers once remarked that when the Jewish people stood at the base of Mount Sinai, so the Torah says, "Vayisatzu betachtis ahar." They camped at the base of the mountain. Vayichan sham neged ahar, and it uses the singular word. He camped opposite the mountain. And Rashi, one of the commentaries, says, why does it say singular, he camped? It should say they camped. It's referring to the nation of Israel. And Rashi says something amazing. Ish echad belev echad. Because when we camped at Mount Sinai, we were one people with one heart. And one of my great wise teachers once said, it doesn't say one people with one opinion. Because that has never happened and will never happen. Our goal is not to be monolithic. Our goal is not to agree. Our goal is not that we should all see things exactly the same way, believe the same way, practice the same way, observe. That's not our goal. But our goal is to be a united people, even with all of our differences. People think that in order to have shalom, in order to have peace, in order to have unity, everyone has to be the same. But it's not true. We never were all the same, and we never will all be the same. Our challenge is to figure out how to make inroads to national unity, not despite our differences, but while embracing our differences. And I'm so thankful that I'm here with you this morning, because you ladies are doing this. You're bringing the Jewish people together. You're bringing communities together. I would just suggest, does everyone here know each other? Adventure or not. We're not going to go around the room now. But what I would tell you is, I would suggest that buying an Israel bond is maybe only one piece of the morning. Get to meet people who are not in your community. Get to meet people who are not in your social circle. Get to meet people who don't daven in your synagogue, who don't have the same friends as you do, who don't maybe even live the same lifestyle as you do. You're all here in one room together. There aren't many opportunities like this that you have to bring an entire community together, and you're doing it. All of you are here. All of you have showed up. And to me, what this morning represents is a beautiful little snapshot of what the Jewish people could look like. This is what it could be. Not just on a beautiful sunny Wednesday. Today's Wednesday? Right? Wednesday. Long week. Beautiful sunny Wednesday morning in a beautiful home. This could be like this every single day. If we figure out a way to come close to one another, we won't solve the differences and we will never see eye to eye on certain things. But that's okay. Because you could love your fellow Jew even if you disagree with them ideologically in every single area. And you could hold someone close to your heart even if your mindset are worlds apart. I give you ladies an incredible yashar koach. A thank you, first of all, for inviting me to be here with you. Because to be able to observe such a beautiful unity on days which we commemorate so much national dysfunction is such a breath of fresh air and gives me a renewed hope for the future. But that's not my speech. What I want to talk to you a little bit about is Eretz Yisrael is the land of Israel and what it means to us and why it's important to us. And ultimately, again, what it contributes to us. Because we all love Israel. Obviously, I'm assuming if you're here, you love Israel, you love the biblical land of Israel, you love the state of Israel. But what does Israel mean for us as a people? And I want to share with you an idea that I think is exceptionally important and I think resonates with incredible importance all the time, but especially during this time of year. There's an amazing verse in Psalms. King David writes, this is in chapter 137, verse 1 of Psalms. A beautiful verse that some of us actually recite every day. Al naros bavel, sham yashavnu gam bachinu bizachreinu esiyo. A very emotional verse. King David writes, or prophetically King David wrote, Al naros bavel, by the rivers of Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon, sham yashavnu. That's where we sat, gam bachinu, and we cried, bizachreinu esil, when we remembered Zion, when we remembered the land of Israel. And the rabbis explain, what is this verse referring to? When we sat by the rivers of Babylon, and we cried, And the rabbis explained that this verse is referring to the destruction of the first temple. The first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king, the emperor of the Babylonian Empire, and he exiles the Jews outside of the land of Israel into Greater Babylon. And this verse is a snapshot. We're being led out together, our families, men, women, children, all being led out. And our Babylonian captors gave us a few moments of respite to drink by the waters, by the rivers of Babylon. And the rabbis explain a dramatic scene. The Medrash, which is filled with homiletic ideas of the rabbis trying to express different ideas and notions, explains that the prophet Jeremiah, who was the prophet of destruction, he was the one who prophesied about the destruction of the temples and all of the terrible things that would happen to the Jewish people. He sees the temple being destroyed, he sees the Jews being exiled, and no one's intervening. No one could change God's mind. So he goes to awaken the prophet Moses from the grave. He says, "Moses, you have to come, you have to come, we need you." Moses says, "What's wrong?" Remember, Moses is in retirement already. He's done. He did his part. Right? So what do you need? And Jeremiah can't say the words. He can't say, "The temple's been destroyed. The Jews are being exiled. You have to come." So he says, "Just come. I need to show you what happened to your people." Jeremiah, if you can imagine this scene, takes Moses by the hand, leads him down the path that the Jewish people are being exiled. And he sees the Jewish people sitting by the banks of the rivers of Babylon. And he says to Jeremiah, "What happened? I led them to the land. I handed them over to Joshua. They were supposed to live in this land for the rest of their lives. What happened?" And Jeremiah very quickly tells him about the breakdown of Jewish society that ultimately culminates in the destruction of the temple and the exile of the Jews from our national homeland. And the Medrash says something amazing. I want to quote to you. What happens? Ra'uhu le-Moshe. The Jewish people sitting by the banks of the river of Babylon see the prophet Jeremiah, who they knew, but they see him coming with Moshe Rabbeinu, the great prophet Moses. And the Jewish people get all excited. They say, "Ba ben Amram mikivro liftosenu miyad sarenu." They say, "Look, Moses is here." And you know, when Moses shows up, it's always good news. Because when Moses shows up, what's going to happen next? Salvation. When Moses showed up when we were enslaved in Egypt, he was the messenger of God, he redeemed us. Moses is here and he's going to redeem us from our Babylonian captors and take us back into the land. And Moshe says something so dramatically heartbreaking to the Jewish people. "Banai, lahachzir eschem I efshar." My dear children, I can't bring you home. I could do so much, Moses says. I could split seas, I could stare down tyrannical pharaohs, I can lead battles against all different nations, but this time I can't bring you home. Shekvar nigzira gizera, because this is the decree of God. But I'll give you a blessing. Hamokom yachzir eschem b'mehira. God should bring you back speedily to your land. And with this, the great prophet Moshe turns around and returns back to the grave. The Jewish people's response to this dramatic encounter: "Eich nashir ashir Hashem al admas nechar." The Jewish people say, "Well, you know what? I guess if Moses can't redeem us, I guess if we're stuck here, we've lost our ability to sing. How can we sing when we don't live in the land of Israel? How can we sing when we've been exiled? How can we sing when we've suffered so much destruction?" And the Jewish people are ready to give up singing. You know, singing is very important within our religion. We know that when the temple stood, you could not offer up sacrifices without Levitic song. There was the Levitic choir. You know, sometimes you wouldn't know this because, you know, when the Kohanim get up to Duchen, you know, on Yom Tov, it doesn't sound exactly melodic. You know, but I have good news for you. That's because the Kohanim are not the singers. The Levites, the Levim, are the singers. We'll have to get them up there soon and see what they're made of. The Jewish people, in response to this cataclysmic tragedy of destruction of the temple, of exile, that even Moses can't bring us back, say, "Eich nashir eshir Hashem." How can we ever sing again when we have been exiled from our land? And when you look at that verse in Psalms, it sounds like that maybe we can no longer sing. Maybe singing is something that we'll have to shelve until the Messiah comes, Messianic redemption occurs, we'll all be brought back to our land, land of Israel be rebuilt. Somehow the Messiah will solve all of our problems. Not sure how the Messiah is going to pull that off. But somehow, some way, he'll solve all of our problems and then we'll sing. Eich Nashir. How can we sing anymore when everything is in such a state of disrepair? But I want to share with you an incredible idea. There was an article written in October of 2002 by Rabbi Stuart Weiss. Rabbi Weiss, who some of you may know, lives in Ranana. Rabbi Weiss's son, Ari, was a member of the IDF, Israel Defense Forces, and was killed in combat. Rabbi Weiss is an individual, again, who truly tries to make bridges within the Jewish people. And he wrote an article that was commemorating the Yahrzeit, the anniversary of the death of his son. And he wrote about another fallen soldier. And I want to read to you a part of this article, because the story is gripping, but also because it helps us understand whether or not we actually have lost the ability to sing. Rabbi Weiss writes, "You might walk past it 1,000 times, even tread directly upon it, and yet you would never probably take note of it. Amid the silent hills and grassy quietude of Mount Herzl, a gentle spring wind blows over the grave of one man, Baruch Shapiro. Barely an echo of his name remains. But the story of Baruch Shapiro, now buried itself by the years, begs to be retold." And he goes on to explain the story of this young man, Baruch Shapiro, who died in the War of Independence. Tells of his father. His father, Chaim Shapiro, went through the 7 levels of hell. He survived 4 concentration camps, not to mention the ghetto and forced marches. He began the war with 8 children and a wonderful wife. And in a little over a year, he lost his wife and 7 of his children without ever having the chance to even sit Shiva. He was finally liberated from Buchenwald with his only surviving son, Baruch, and they wallowed in the DP camps for nearly 3 years until finally in 1948 they found a place aboard an immigrant ship and arrived in Israel a week later. Israel, in the midst of the War of Independence, was fighting a desperate battle for survival against overwhelming odds. And so Baruch Shapiro, young Baruch Shapiro, volunteered to fight. With no previous training, he was taken to a ravine, handed a rifle, taught how to shoot a full few bullets, and sent off to war. Meanwhile, with the stipend that he received from the Jewish agency, his father Chaim rented a small apartment outside Tel Aviv. Baruch Shapiro distinguished himself in battle as part of the Harel Brigade, fighting under Yitzhak Rabin to break the Arab siege on Jerusalem. Baruch received a field commission as an officer and was awarded a medal for bravery under fire. And then one day, as Chaim Shapiro was sitting in his tiny living room in Tel Aviv, he glanced out of the window and saw one of those terrible delegations heading up the path to his apartment. They say that Chaim Shapiro opened the door before they knocked. And they say that he never even read the telegram. Just crumpled it over and over in his hands. When a soldier in Israel is killed, the army takes care of everything, including the funeral arrangements. Chaim Shapiro had only one request. He wanted his son, who had died fighting for Jerusalem, to be buried in Jerusalem, on Mount Herzl, the National Cemetery. The next afternoon, hundreds of mourners gathered at Mount Herzl. Most of them had never known Baruch Shapiro or his father, but they heard of the terrible tragedy and wanted to pay their respects. After all, what Hitler had not finished in the crematoria had ended at the hands of an Arab bullet. This was the last Shapiro's son, the end of a line. An overwhelming sense of loss pervaded the day, for those assembled knew the unique circumstances of the Shapiro family and wished to demonstrate their solidarity with the aging father, whose family line had come to a sudden, tragic end. During the brief ceremony, I can't do justice to Rabbi Weiss's words by paraphrasing, as I'm reading it to you. During the brief ceremony, Chaim remained silent. He listened impassively as the appropriate psalms and prayers were recited, and as Baruch's commanding officer eulogized him as an exemplary soldier. But when the flag-draped coffin was lowered into the grave, Chaim Shapiro suddenly began to sing, quietly at first, then more loudly. He sang, "Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people lives," over and over. Then he began to dance, grabbing some of Baruch's friends and pulling them into a circle. The crowd looked on in horror. Surely the father had lost his mind. Clearly, the enormity of the loss of his last remaining child had finally pushed him over the brink. Those standing closest to Chaim tried to calm him down, to console him. The chief of staff put his arm around him and urged him to sit down. But Chaim pushed the general away and carried on singing and dancing. After several minutes, the elderly man turned towards the crowd and began to speak. "I am sure you think I have gone quite mad," he said. "But I can assure you that I am in complete control of my faculties. I know you think it outrageous that I should sing at my boy's burial, but I want to explain why nothing could be more appropriate. You see," the father went on, "when the rest of my family were murdered in Poland by the Germans, their lives ended in silence. They vanished in the wink of an eye. They were snuffed out like candles and no one saw or heard. No one took notice of who they were, what they had done, or what their lives had meant. To live and die in Poland was an empty and barren experience containing only sadness and regret. It was the waste of precious life. But my son, Chaim, this son is different. But my son, Baruch, is different. Baruch lived to walk upon the holy earth of Eretz Yisrael. And he died defending Jerusalem. Jerusalem, a place we never dreamed we would see in our lifetimes. Baruch gave his life for all the people of Israel so they could be free, safe, and independent. This was not the waste of a life. It is the celebration of a life. And that is why I sing today. As I say shalom to my son. And that is why all of you should sing with me." With that, Chaim Shapiro began to sing Am Yisrael Chai once more. And the assembled throng began to join in, until every voice in the cemetery was raised in a surrealistic song of sadness and joy. The tears of each emotion mingled on every face. For a long time they sang together, until the hills of Jerusalem themselves seemed to be joining in the chorus. You see, my friends, our ancestors were wrong. They thought that with the destruction of the temple, they thought with the enormity of our losses that we lost the power to sing. But we have not lost the power to sing. Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, continues to sing. But do you know why we have the power to sing? Our power to sing comes from the land of Israel. Because as long as the land is in existence, even if we don't have the merit to inhabit it, the land fuels our continued ability to survive. The land fuels our continued ability to sing. The land fuels our continued ability to thrive. There is an almost ununderstandable synergistic relationship between the Jew and the land of Israel. My heart is the land of Israel, and the land of Israel is my heart. So as long as that land is there, the blood of vitality continues to course through my veins. As long as the land of Israel is in existence, and there is vitality and Jewish settlement there, then we have the ability to sing. The land fuels us. I want to tell you something. You think you're here to help the land of Israel? I have news for you. I'm sorry, Israel Bonds chairperson. The land of Israel does much more for you than you can ever do for the land. Because every little bit of optimism we have in our Jewish soul, every ray of light, every bit of hope that we have, emanates from our precious soil. You see, the entire Jewish experience can be seen in the land of Israel. If you think about it, Hashem gave us this little land. The truth is, biblical Israel is bigger than the current state of Israel. But still in the scheme of things, gave us this little sliver of land. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew, God knew, that this little piece of land was going to be surrounded by enemies on all sides. All sides. And by the way, when I say all sides, you know that unfortunately the enemies of the state of Israel are not just the hostile nations that are geographic neighbors, but the hostility towards our beautiful Israel has grown to epic proportions. I'm sure many of you have seen the interesting article in the Jerusalem Post today. PETA, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, came out with a statement today blasting the fact that Hamas started lighting birds on fire and sending them over the border. You know, this is the current kite thing. You know, so now PETA came out with a statement. How can you treat the birds? How about a statement when innocent Jews are killed because of suicide bombers? I don't care about the birds. I care about the birds. Don't get me wrong, but I care a lot more about human life, Jewish and non-Jewish, than I care about Hamas setting birds on fire. Our enemies, the enemies of the state of Israel, unfortunately, again, span the entire world. And God knew that. God had a plan. He knew what He was doing. But despite all of those enemies, we continue on. How is it that God gives us the only piece of real estate in the Middle East that doesn't have oil? My gosh, everyone else has oil. Everyone else has oil. And one little piece of the Middle East, the one sliver of land, doesn't have oil. So there's an answer for that also. What's the answer to that? Natural gas found in the Mediterranean. Right? But even that, who owns it? Different, right? But again, and the land of Israel for so many years was barren, swamplands, sand dunes. And look at the times we live in. You know what the greatest challenge that we encounter when we go to the land of Israel, go to the state of Israel today? Waldorf or David's Citadel? Waldorf or David's Citadel? You know, it's so hard. Or Mamila, it's also beautiful. King David, I think, is passé already. You know, we've got... These are our challenges. These are our challenges. Because the land of Israel has overcome immense odds. The land of Israel has gone from a desert and swampland to becoming, as was mentioned before, a first world economy. That is a first world economy in terms of exports of technology, of different military technology, of produce. What the land of Israel has become in just the short number of years since the founding of a state is incredible. Sounds a lot like whose story? Sounds a lot like our story. Because, you know, you're sitting here in this beautiful, spacious home, raising money, living in an age of unprecedented Jewish wealth. Less than a century after the worst catastrophe our people have ever endured. We stand here trying to figure out how much money we should give, less than 100 years after our people were nearly decimated. The story of the Jewish people and the story of the land of Israel is one story. The land sees itself in us, and we see ourselves in the land. The land has come back to life so many times. Our people has come back to life so many times. The land regenerates and we regenerate. So we have the ability to sing. Our ability to sing comes from our land. You see, our ancestors thought that if you can't live on the land, then you can't derive the strength of the land. But we know that's not correct. You could be 6,000 miles away, but the koach, the strength, the hope, the optimism, the joie de vivre, the excitement, the drive that we have comes from our precious soil. It doesn't come from us, from inside us. Well, it comes from inside us, but it comes via Eretz Yisrael. Everything we are, the energy, the hope, the optimism we have, that is the inconquerable Jewish spirit, comes from our beautiful land. The land regenerated was reborn. We regenerate and are reborn as well. The land has gone through it multiple times. We go through it multiple times. This is the synergistic relationship between the Jewish people and between the land of Israel. And it is this synergistic relationship that allows us to keep singing, no matter how overwhelming the enormity of our reality may be. You know, unfortunately, we sometimes lose sight of this incredible gift. And I'll conclude with this. Well, actually, I'm not going to conclude with this. I'm going to conclude with two more things. But sometimes we lose sight of this incredible reality. You know, I'm not going to get political in this talk. You never get political at fundraisers. Never a good idea. There are some very real challenges that the modern day state of Israel deals with. And many of us feel passionately about those contemporary challenges. You know, this is the first time in our history that we've ever had a democracy. You know, biblical Israel was not a democracy. It was a theocracy. There was a king. This is the first time in the history of our people we've ever had a democratic state. We want a democratic state, but we also want a Jewish state. So who defines what a Jewish state is? Who defines who should be able to pray where and what kind of prayer? These are big, difficult issues, and issues that often tear us apart. But sometimes we make the horrible mistake of forgetting the enormity of the blessing because we get so mired just in some of the real technical challenges. You know, it reminds me of a story. A Jewish grandmother, call her Mrs. Schwartz, takes her grandson to the beach. The little boy is playing so beautifully. And then Nebuch, a massive wave comes along, sweeps the boy away. Mrs. Schwartz looks up to the heaven and she says, God, what just happened over here? I've always been good. I've always done everything. I brought Israel bonds every single time. What's the highest one? What's the highest? The Jubilee. I bought 3 Jubilees, right? On a Wednesday morning. I did everything you ever wanted me to do. And now you take my grandson. This is my only grandson, my future progeny. The silence from the heavens. Another wave rolls in. And the little boy is washed up on shore again. Mrs. Schwartz looks heavenward and she says, God, he had a hat. Sometimes, we forget about the great blessings we have when we get so mired in the technical details. I'm not minimizing the current issues that are unfolding in the state of Israel. And I'm not minimizing the difficulty that there is in deciding who defines the religious standards of a religious state. Who defines, ultimately, again, how a Jewish army goes ahead and fights against terrorists. Who defines, ultimately, again, if civilian casualties are the right cost to pay in order to safeguard Israeli citizens. These are difficult questions. But it's a privilege that we have the ability to ask them. But we're living now in a time where people are withdrawing their support from the state of Israel because they don't like the stances of the government, they don't like the stances of the chief rabbinate, and again, everyone is entitled to have all of their opinions on all of those issues. But to hinge your love on the land of Israel based on governments that come and go, based on rabbis that come and go, is you're missing the point of the relationship. The relationship fuels who and what we are. The relationship makes us us. It's the vitality of the land that creates the vitality we feel within. The grandson has been returned. Let's not obsess over the hat. For the first time in 2,000 years, there is a Jewish homeland. For the first time in 2,000 years, the only thing that is standing between you and standing in Jerusalem is the cost of a plane ticket. That is the only obstacle. And when you get to beautiful Ben Gurion Airport, and I think it's the most magnificent airport. I'm not really a world traveler. For me, it's either Baltimore or Israel. I don't get out much otherwise. So I don't have any frame reference, but it's a beautiful airport. You know why it's beautiful? You know why it's beautiful? Because you know what happens when you walk down that corridor and you're right about to go into border control? And what do you see there on the right side of the doorway of the hallway? That oversized mezuzah. For years, it was the British. For years, it was the Turks. For years, it was the Crusaders. For years, it was someone else at that border who told us if we could come in or we can't come in. My dear friends, no one tells us what we can do or what we can't do. You want to book the ticket, you could be there tomorrow afternoon and you could put your hand on that precious mezuzah. These are the times that we live in. These are the times that we are privileged to be a part of. It is imperfect because life is imperfect. Jews are imperfect. People are imperfect. The world is imperfect. And those imperfections will always be part of the mix. But we have to be global people. We have to be able to see beyond the hats and be able to go ahead and see the incredible gift. Because that gift has reunited us with our land. And that reunification with our beautiful land has caused our Jewish blood to course with even greater vitality. And I just want to end off with one last piece. I want to tell you where I learned this lesson. And this is really where I'll conclude. I learned this lesson. I think I told you part of this story at Linda and Kayla's installation. But I learned this lesson about what the land of Israel does for us from a very interesting place. I once had to go to Israel for a conference. I was speaking somewhere. But because of scheduling, I couldn't stay overnight. So I took an afternoon flight out of Newark. I got to Israel in the morning, and I was leaving that night. It was the last day of Hanukkah. And so I decided that, you know, it's last day of Hanukkah, I wanted to go to Daven by the Kotel, Daven by the Western Wall. Hanukkah is the Yom Tov of rededication of the temple. And I wanted to be able to go and to feel a little bit of that beautiful Yom Tov there at that sacred place. And I'm standing there davening Mincha, and I always say, you know, Israel, the best thing about Israel is all you need to do is stand around, keep your eyes open, and something dramatic is going to unfold. It doesn't make it, because again, it's a country of Jews. So something's either going to go really right, something's either going to go really wrong, right? Some people are going to make shalom, somebody's going to tell you how to parent your kid, or someone's going to yell at you because you're driving like this, or someone is going to lend you $5 because, or 5 shekel because you didn't have, whatever it is. Standing by the Kotel, and I see this man, young man, comes with a couple of his children, two boys and a girl. And the little girl was in a wheelchair. And he brings the children up to the Kotel, they're all kissing the walls. And he takes his daughter out of the wheelchair, and he leans her against the wall. And he leans her against the wall, and then he pulls the other kids back. And you know, sometimes when you see something spectacular, you want to see it, but you don't want to look. I'm looking at this little girl who can't support herself with her own feet, but is being held up by 2,000-year-old stones of the Jewish people. And it was in that moment that I realized, we think we hold the land of Israel up. It's the land of Israel which holds us up. We have the great privilege to do our small part in sustaining our beautiful new state. And it is new. Because, you know, in the realm of the Jewish people, anything less than 1,000 years is like yesterday. We live in dramatically new times. We have a state. We have a homeland that is ours. And we often think that we're holding her up. But like that little girl who taught me so much, I realize she's holding us up. And she holds us up every day. And she holds us up with her optimism, with her hope. She holds us up with her vitality. She holds us up with the belief that no matter how difficult things may be, we will always persevere, not just survive. We'll always persevere. We'll always accomplish. We'll always do great things. All of you today have the merit and the distinct privilege to help hold her up. And that privilege, may we be blessed to feel the beautiful embrace of our magnificent land, to feel the beautiful kiss on the forehead by our benevolent God. May we be privileged to continue to sing, to continue to regenerate, no matter what our circumstances in life. May we be privileged to be just a bit more like our land. May we be privileged to experience a renaissance, no matter how much of setbacks we have experienced. May we be privileged to finally have the day where your future events will not be held here, sorry, but God willing, will be held in a rebuilt Israel, in a rebuilt Jerusalem, surrounded by every single man, woman, and child who, despite their differences of opinion, come together as one people with one heart. Thank you.